Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulippe. Today, conversations with Bill Bennett, principal oboist with the San Francisco Symphony, who will be performing the Richard Strauss Oboe Concerto this week with the San Francisco Symphony. SF Performance's elucidator-in-chief, Robert Greenberg, will also be in studio, as will Smuin Ballet executive and artistic director, Celia Fushiel. Stay with us. Well, there's been much hype about the exercise in self-congratulation known as the Oscars this week, and my first guest actually has a brush with, or maybe we should say a dance with, cinematic history, as she, under a considerable amount of costume, was one of the dancers for none other than Jabba the Hutt in the 1997 DVD re-release of The Return of the Jedi, which restored a dance scene that ended up on the original cutting room floor. Better known today with the title of executive and artistic director of the Smuin Ballet, she nonetheless still receives fan mail for her very green, bug-eyed portrayal of Griata, the Rodian dancer. Out of Hollywood makeup now, but just as radiant and alluring to both earthlings and aliens alike, I imagine. Celia Fushiel joins me now in studio. Celia, welcome back to KLW.
Hello, David. Good to be here.
Well, you're here to talk about the Smuin Ballet's current and future offerings, of course, but since I opened that box, let's go there briefly. Now, just how did you wind up dancing for the notorious Jabba the Hutt?
Well, our founder, Michael Smuin, had been hired by George Lucas to choreograph some scenes that he had always wanted to drop into the original pictures, but with his budget restrictions was unable to do so. And so with the re-release, George asked Michael to choreograph these scenes, and one of them were these, I call them the Alien Supremes. We were entertaining Jabba in his palace. And so there I was as a Rodian. I was Greedo's sister, Griata, in the film. What was probably a half day of shooting ended up with about maybe 90 seconds in the film, but there I am, and I understand why they're called fans, because they are fanatical, and I do get mail from all over the world, and perhaps on my tombstone it will say, "Here lies Griata."
But I hope a more alluring picture will be included than the one that for the, you in makeup.
Hopefully.
Now, the winter program of the Smuin Ballet includes three works choreographed by founder Michael Smuin. Now, for those listeners who aren't familiar with Michael's life and work, could you perhaps just give us a brief history?
Michael had a very varied background. He started with tap dancing, he learned ballet, he had a stint on Broadway, he learned ballroom dancing, nightclub performing, so he had a wealth of styles that he brought to his work. He was co-director of the San Francisco Ballet for many years, and in 1994 started Smuin Ballet, his own company, which was a vehicle for his works. So he felt thrilled that what he loved doing, he could turn into work for many of us and pleasure for many fans of his from the San Francisco Ballet days. So, unfortunately, we lost Michael almost 6 years ago now, in 2007, and we're maintaining his legacy by keeping his works alive and visible on the stage, but moving the art form forward as well.
You were described as Michael's muse, and now you're carrying out his legacy, as you mentioned. Is that getting more difficult as the years since his passing accumulate?
Is it difficult to keep it going?
Yeah, it is because, for some, I'm sure.
It is because there's a balance. Obviously, Michael is gone, and so we're not going to have new works of his per se, and he was his own artistic voice. And so I can look for choreographers that might create something in a similar vein. In the spring, we'll see something like that with the work of a young choreographer who's going to be using some jazz music, something that Michael might have selected. But as far as a unique voice to, that was Michael's gift. So it won't be exactly the same. However, we keep that same spirit alive, and we try to choose works that continue to entertain and excite, but also challenge people. I'm bringing in new works, mm-hmm. and some of this is evident on this new program.
We'll talk about those new works in a moment, but three of the works of Michael's that are being staged are Star Shadows, which is set to the wonderful music of Ravel's Piano Concerto in G Major, Homeless, which is a solo work, and No Vivire, another solo with some flavorings of Latin American rhythms. Now, I'm wondering, though, these were originally choreographed by Michael. Are they notated, or is it more through memory, through notes, or video recordings that you're recreating these choreographed works?
That's a great question, David. There used to be in use two different types of dance notation, but with the use of video, they have become obsolete. So most often, it is memory. Michael did choreograph to a score, so I have his Ravel score, and he may have made cryptic notes in there. But it's a combination of his notes, my use of his score, and video. Those of us that were in those pieces recreate them and restage them on the new dancers. And so that's what we did with these three pieces of Michael's.
I imagine that technology is expanding as well. I'm thinking, as a tennis fan, seeing, you know, these spot shots things where you can see every serve that a tennis player makes, you could probably do something like that as a, you know, choreographing the stage as a massive spot shot and just tracing the dancers as they dance.
It's true. What we're doing now is not only recording performances, because, as you can imagine, a video of a performance would also record any errors that might have happened. So what we will do sometimes now is record the rehearsals in the studio. So when you're not dealing with the situation of nerves, perhaps on the stage, you can actually go back so that things are recorded as they were intended.
Let's talk about some of the new works that are being done. Cold Virtues by Adam Hoagland, and one by Trey McIntyre called O Inverted World. Share with us some of the details about this.
O Inverted World was a work that I commissioned from Trey McIntyre, and I had hoped that he would select music in the public domain, hence my concern about budget. And a few weeks before he was coming out, he said, "Well, Celia, what I'd really like to do is create a ballet to the music of the Shins, a young indie rock group out of Portland." And I was very anxious about that, what that potential cost would be, but the Shins worked with us, and it's been really thrilling. So this was a work that was actually created on my dancers. Trey has his own company in Boise, Idaho, tours around nationally quite a bit, but it was a real unique experience to get to work with him. It was created in 2010, and it just had its New York premiere last August, to great success, and so I really wanted to bring it back to this audience one more time. And it's a piece for eight dancers, four men and four women. Very different choreography. The women are not on point. It's very athletic, unusual in comparison to anything we've done. And yet it still has a certain spirit that Michael would have enjoyed. I kind of equate it to Michael having created works to a composer that a group that he was inspired by, the Beatles, right? So Michael did a work to the Beatles, and in the same way, Trey is a younger choreographer, again, creating to something that's a little bit more popular music and using that as his source of inspiration.
Well, let's back up a moment to your wearing your hat, as you mentioned earlier, as executive director. You've got to be aware of budget and things. Now, for those that aren't familiar with the whole process of rights and music rights, particularly, how does that play into your role as artistic director, wanting to let a choreographer do something to the music that they wish, and yet, what kind of restrictions are you under for securing rights? How does one secure rights for a work?
One has to contact either the composer or the producer of the album, the recording label. So there are various avenues that have to be pursued, and that they're not for broadcast. So they're specifically for live performance. They want to know where they're going to be performed, how large the theaters are, what the actual audience is going to be. So, for instance, it was a different thing for United Airlines to contact the Gershwin Trust to use music for all of their advertising. That's worldwide rights and broadcasting. So that must have been
massive. We're talking about lots of dollars here.
Absolutely.
So it can range from a couple of $100s to literally thousands and thousands of dollars.
Absolutely. So it is a concern, though, for my budget. So if I can't find a sponsor, I'd really need to try to steer somebody into the public domain if it's that's at all possible.
You couldn't even do it to Happy Birthday because you'd have to pay some rights for Happy Birthday. Those ladies that own Happy Birthday will come right after you. So does Smuin do anything to live music?
We have not often done music, had music live. One time we did do a Brahms piece, and our company pianist did, in fact, play live. But it would be prohibitive for us to be able to do that. Part of our accessibility and our versatility, and certainly in the use of popular music, it would require a recording.
Sure.
But I don't discount it. I would love to use something, a beautiful string quartet or something sometime. I would love to work that out sometime. But in terms of the way we structure our season around the Bay Area, it would be another expense for us, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thrilled to see, for the first time, the Christmas Ballet this past December. Darren Anderson came on and talked about his work with Smuin. And I'm really looking forward to this winter program. One of the works being choreographed is a work by Philip Glass by Adam Hoagland. Could you talk about Cold Virtues a little bit?
This work was created on the Louisville Ballet, where Adam is resident choreographer. And so, unlike O Inverted World, which was created on my dancers, this ballet was created on other dancers, and in fact, one of the lead dancers came out to teach it to my dancers. And it's a work for 14 dancers, so nearly the entire company is in the ballet, full company piece. It's really a dramatic, emotional piece. That score is so spectacular, and it's so fitting. It loosely follows the narrative of Dangerous Liaisons, and you have a woman who's just pretty much sets out to ruin people's lives and their relationships, and in the end only ruins herself. But it's not a strict narrative, but it takes place in a 1930s speakeasy. That's sort of the era that we're talking about. But the dancers have really risen to the challenge, and it is a fantastic vehicle for the company.
Celia, I want to thank you for taking a little bit of time. The program runs through Sunday at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts, and then March 8th and 9th at the Sunset Center. More information at smuinballet.org, S-M-U-I-N, ballet.org. Three short works, originally choreographed by Michael Smuin, O Inverted World by Trey McIntyre, set to the music of The Shins, and Cold Virtues by Adam Hoagland, set to Philip Glass's Violin Concerto. We're going to hear the first movement of that in just a moment. Thank you for spending some time with us today, Celia.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And if you, listeners, if you stare at your radio very, very intently, you might be able to see the actual choreography of Adam Hoagland as you're listening to Philip Glass. Just kidding. Here's the music of Philip Glass. Thank you. That's music of Philip Glass, which will be choreographed by Adam Hoagland in a piece called Cold Virtues by the Smuin Ballet. Remaining performances at Mountain View through this Sunday, also March 8th and 9th at the Sunset Center, smuinballet.org for more details. Good afternoon once again. I'm David Latilib, your host for Open Air. Still to come, a conversation with Bill Bennett, principal oboist of the San Francisco Symphony, who will be performing the Richard Strauss Oboe Concerto this week with the San Francisco Symphony under Tortelier, guest conductor. Next, though, no stranger to our airwaves here at KALW, American composer, pianist, and musicologist Robert Greenberg has served on the faculties of UC Berkeley, California State University, East Bay, and the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, where he was chairman of the Department of Music History and Literature and director of the Adult Extension Division. He's currently music historian in residence with San Francisco Performances, where he has lectured and performed since 1994. He hosts their Saturday morning series, a lecture combined with performances with the Alexander String Quartet, a series which was brought to the KALW airwaves by the name of Explorations in Music, thanks to the inspiring guidance of my predecessor here at KLW, Alan Farley, who served as original host of the series. Dr. Greenberg has recorded a number of lecture series for the Teaching Company on music history and the appreciation of music. He often relates the musical topics to other areas such as history, politics, as well as other music from different periods, always with a great sense of humor, which really draws the listener in. Referred to as the Elvis of music history and appreciation, I'm delighted that Elvis is in the room. Robert Greenberg, welcome once again to the afternoon airwaves of KLW.
Thank you, David. I wish I'd left my I left my jumpsuit in the car. I would have worn it otherwise.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, for those that can't see through the radio waves, it's kind of an older Elvis that you're going for here, I see.
Yes, the a kind of wide Las Vegas Elvis as opposed to the good Memphis Elvis.
Now, you've been doing the live version of Explorations in Music since 1994, together with the Alexander String Quartet, exploring the works of Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, Schubert, as well as surveys of some more challenging composers like Bartok and Shostakovich. Now, our broadcast series will continue, I believe, later this fall with your latest subject, Benjamin Britten. Two of those live programs having already taken place, and two to come in March. This is the Britten Centenary, but how and who came up with the idea to explore Benjamin Britten in the way that you're doing?
The way we usually do this is that the quartet comes up with a basic chunk of repertoire that they want to focus on, and after all, that's fair. They have to learn the pieces. There was a great interest in doing something to celebrate the centennial year of Britten. He wrote three numbered string quartets and then another piece called the Divertimento for String Quartet. So four works all in all. And so it was a matter of coming up with a rubric that would allow us to do these pieces and fill out others. And so we came up with this idea, we meaning the quartet and myself, of doing something called the String Quartet in a Time of War, and focusing on other composers like Britten who were profoundly affected by World War II, as was everyone who grew up in that generation. So we are pairing Britten's works, one in each of the four concerts, with another appropriate composer, another appropriate string quartet that somehow reflects the experience of World War II. In our first concert, we did Britten along with Pavel Haas. Haas was a Czech composer who wrote his quartet, this third quartet, in 37 and 38, and who perished at Auschwitz. Our second concert, again, one that has already taken place, paired Béla Bartók's string quartet number 6 of 1939 with Britten's first quartet. Our upcoming concert,
that program called Their Finest Hour.
Yeah, yeah. I entitled each of the four programs using titles from Winston Churchill's memoirs of the Second World War, and I called that one Their Finest Hour because these were works that were written just as the war was beginning, and they were works of very, very powerful sense of indignity, anger, frustration, and rage at what was happening. The next concert focuses on works that are just immediately post-war, 1945, works by William Walton, his string quartet, and then the Britten II. And finally, at the very end of the course, we're doing two pieces written a good bit later. We're doing the Shostakovich 8, which dates from the early 60s, and Britten's last major work, which was his third quartet, which dates from the 70s. Works that have a certain valedictory quality to them, but that also reflect in many ways back on the war years and on issues brought up by the war.
So this is much more than just a music appreciation course, so to speak. Here are the dates in the history. You've tied in, as you mentioned, Churchill. You're tying in a lot more history and some anecdotes. And perhaps you can share with us something about this second string quartet, which we'll hear. What would you be talking about the second string quartet of Benjamin Britten? How are you tying things in?
Well, you take two tacks, or at least I take two tacks right away. We need to talk about the music in an absolute sort of way. What's the piece all about? What does it accomplish? But we also have to talk about the circumstances that brought its creation about, the context. The context here is fascinating because Britten, who was a conscientious objector, who even left England just before the war began and spent a few years in the United States before going back, to much criticism, actually, ended up throwing himself into the war effort to the degree he could, which was through music. And when the war ended, he met Yehudi Menuhin at a party, and Menuhin told Britten that he, Menuhin, was about to go to Germany to play for displaced people, mostly at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. And Britten was galvanized. He said, "I want to be your pianist." Well, there already was a pianist, but that pianist stepped aside, and it was Britten who went with Yehudi Menuhin and toured Germany in the fall of 1945 and got to see firsthand the destruction of both the physical aspect of Germany and the destruction foisted on the lives of the displaced people that he played for. He was deeply moved, and he came back and wrote this string quartet.
That's got to change his entire oeuvre after that, I mean, in terms of the emphasis that he must have developed from that.
Certainly it would, and, you know, it's always hard to say specifically in a piece of music, instrumental music, which lacks words to explain its essence, it's always difficult to say this means that, and that means this, and this was inspired by such. So I try not to do that unless it's completely obvious, but we can't help but feel that this quartet and its intensity and restlessness of spirit, lack of resolution across its surface, is a product of the complex emotions stirred up by what he was witness to.
Let's hear a little bit of that Britten String Quartet number 2, the first movement, now here on KALW. That's a brief excerpt from the second quartet of Benjamin Britten, the Maggini Quartet, performing there. You can hear the Alexander String Quartet perform that, the Alexander String Quartet being Sandy Wilson on cello, Fred Lifshitz on violin, along with Zacharias Graffalo and Paul Yarborough on viola, in a series by SF Performances and Robert Greenberg called The String Quartet at a Time of War, two of those remaining programs on March 9th. March 9th, you'll hear the Benjamin Britten Quartet number 2 and William Walton's Quartet in A Minor. Robert Greenberg, historian-in-chief of SF Performances, joining me in studio. That is some really powerful, powerful music.
Very powerful music. And, of course, the circumstances around its creation intensifies it another hundredfold.
Also on that program for March 9th, and these are at Herbst Hall?
Herbst Theater.
Herbst Theater, is the Walton Quartet in A Minor, dating from 1946. What would you be telling audiences about the Walton?
Again, a little bit about Walton in general, just his background, who he was. He was a wonderful composer, especially of large pieces. And during the war, he was put to work by the English film industry, writing film scores for presumably inspirational and patriotic films. And some of his film scores are really among the very best ever composed, I think. And this string quartet's an interesting piece because it's the first piece of chamber music he wrote in about 5 or 6 years, coming out of these massive film scores and now trying to contain his imagination to the rather restricted timbral and numerical resources of the quartet. And for the most part, he's pretty successful at it. It's a piece that dates from immediately after the war. There's that sense of both joy and energy, and I don't think anything was ever the same after World War II. And the growing threat posed by Russia, by the Soviet Union, kind of undid any of the ecstasy one might feel at having been victorious, along with the just the tremendous losses. So anyway, a piece written right after the war is also going to be affected by the war as well, affected by the mood of things. And so Walton's is. And only in the last movement, after having gone through three very difficult emotional experiences that the first three movements represent, only in the last movement do we get a kind of unbuttoned optimism.
Here is the fourth movement of William Walton's String Quartet. We're hearing the Chrome Quartet on KLW. Chroma Quartet performing the fourth movement of William Walton's String Quartet, part of the March 9 program of SF performances at Herbst Theater, the Alexander String Quartet, with Elucidator-in-Chief Robert Greenberg. Tell me, that quartet, Walton's biographer mentioned that he called it one of his finest achievements and a sure sign, quote, that he had thrown off the trammels of his cinema style and rediscovered his true voice. Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Movie music, as we all should know, is music that serves a higher master. That's what's going on the screen. The moment we actually notice movie music, the music has failed, because it means we're being distracted from the action. It needs to complement and reinforce, but not take away too much of our attention. It also requires a certain, let's say, more traditional palette, I believe, a more conservative musical palette, a musical palette that has to marry up with the action. Now, many of these movies that he was scoring were historical movies based on Shakespeare's plays about various dead English kings. Well, it's impossible to write a piece of, it seems to me, difficult to write a piece of modern-sounding music for a movie score that deals with a 16th century king. So a movie scorer has to be someone who can evoke time and place, but not necessarily someone who's going to call too much attention to him or herself. When you're writing for a string quartet, well, it's time to call all the attention to yourself, and also to concentrate your ideas onto a group that is intimate, quiet, and conversational. Chamber music is very different from orchestral music. Orchestral music is all about putting forward exposing ideas and developing them. Chamber music, by its nature, is conversational music, where interplay must be achieved if it's going to be true chamber music. So it's an entirely different kind of music, entirely different kind of concept of music, and you have to think very differently as well, because now Mr. Walden is on his own. He doesn't have visual impetus to inspire.
Or distract.
Now he has to write a piece of music that is coherent unto itself. Very different process.
Talking with Robert Greenberg, a music historian for the San Francisco Performances series that has been going on for some 20 years now. So, Robert, tell me, how does someone become music historian in residence with San Francisco Performances? What does someone like that do?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I'm going to answer it with any satisfaction. As you mentioned before, for many years I was on the faculty of the San Francisco Conservatory, but frankly, this teaching company, also known now as the Great Courses, a Virginia-based operation, made me an offer I simply couldn't refuse back in 2000, and that was, they'll record anything I want to record. And I've recorded something like 30 courses, over 645-minute lectures.
Wow.
With them for over 20 years. I just got back from the studios in Virginia a couple of weeks ago having recorded another course. They take me about a year to write, and so if I'm going to record, I need a lot of time, and I can't be doing classroom teaching at the same time.
Right. But having... Well, one of those great courses is a monumental 32 CD set on how to listen to and understand opera. Now, how do these differ from your teaching in the classroom?
One must render unto the medium what it demands. Classroom teaching is so easy. You walk in with a... You walk in with half a page of notes. If you're having a good day, well, the words come. If you're having a bad day, you ask a lot of questions. You let the students distract you. You talk about food and baseball. You stand in a TV studio to record a 45-minute lecture, and I record four a day when I do this. There's no ums and ahs. There's no probing. There are no questions. There's no studio audience. There's just three cameras, teleprompters, and you have to make it look and sound natural. And you've got to get the information out with absolute clarity. So everything is written and scripted as if I'd written a book. Everything has been fact-checked by my editors. Everything has been gone over for bad grammatical...
God help you if that happened in the classroom.
Oh, my goodness. And the grammar has to be perfect. Listen, we're selling high-end intellectual stuff. The last thing the snobs and wonderful people who buy this stuff want to hear is incorrect grammar, plurals that don't line up, and so forth. So you have to be careful.
You will hear from them, no
doubt.
Oh,
I do.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I do. My bugbear is mispronunciations of French words. The language defies me. Much as I've tried to beat it into my mouth, I can't. So I'm very aware of who our audience is and what we must give. And recording like this is like recording anything on media. It has to be perfect. So it's an entirely different experience than classroom teaching.
Well, is there any time left for you to compose? You're a composer. What's your latest piece? You have something upcoming that you'd like to spend more time working on rather than this lecture series?
I take a year. I alternate years. And having just finished a course, I now can embark on composing. I'm going to be working on a trio for piano, violin, and cello, for which I've been commissioned, and that will be premiered next year. 2 years ago, I wrote four pieces, two of which have already been premiered. Another one will be premiered in March. And then the Alexander String Quartet with pianist Roger Woodward will be premiering a piano quintet I wrote 2 years ago in 2014. So, yeah, you know... Life's crazy, and if you're a musician, you do 10 different things, and it all adds up to one career.
Sure does. The performances of the String Quartet at a Time of War continue on March 9th and March 16th at Herb's Theater, the Alexander String Quartet with Robert Greenberg, continuing that wonderful series that's been going on for over 20 years, so there's still a chance to catch the course midway. No points will be taken off of your final grade if you catch the March 9th and 16th performances. So... we hope to rebroadcast one of our recent explorations in music this spring, and then the current series on Benjamin Britten and the String Quartet at a Time of War will be broadcast to the best of our knowledge this coming fall with yours truly as host. So we're looking forward to the broadcast version of those concerts. I'd like to also mention that Robert Greenberg's book, How to Listen to Great Music, published by Plume, a division of Penguin Books, back in April of 2011, I'm sure is doing well, in addition to over 600 CDs and part of the Great Courses. Now it's a great way to educate people that in a time of less and less money for music education, this is a great way to reach people. So tell me what else is coming up on your calendar.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have four kids. So what's really coming up on my calendar is taking care of my kids. I have two of them are very young. So my daughter, my six-year-old, just started piano lessons last week. So what's on my calendar right now is working with her every night and making sure she makes really good friends with the piano. I've become, sadly, in my old age, a Facebook person with a fan page that I write for every day. The kind of like mini blogs that you're not supposed to be putting on Facebook, but lo and behold, lots of people seem to be reading them and enjoying them. So I'm doing that. I'm doing a number of trips, opera trips this year. We'll be going, taking a group to Berlin at the beginning of April to hear Daniel Barenboim do The Ring, and then to Parma to hear Verdi, and marking his 200th anniversary of his birth in October. So, yeah, lots of stuff keeps me off the streets for the most part.
All right. You can look up Robert Greenberg on Facebook or otherwise. I'm sure a Google search will bring you up in a flash as well. We're going to end with some of the Shostakovich String Quartet No. 8, which is part of the final program, March 16th. Give us just a minute of introduction for this movement. This is the second movement of the String Quartet No. 8.
Composed in 1960, Shostakovich lived his life under the thumb of Stalin's Soviet Union. How he survived, still a miracle. The piece was supposedly inspired by the destruction of Dresden. He was in Dresden and wrote the quartet in an amazing 3 days. In reality, the piece has nothing to do with Dresden and everything to do with Dmitri Shostakovich. He was forced to join the Communist Party, something he swore he'd never, ever do. But he did, because he was offered a position that he felt would give both himself and his children safety for the remainder of their lives. He was so wrapped up in a depressive, suicidal funk of self-loathing and hatred that this piece was about himself, because he intended to commit suicide.
Music of Dmitri Shostakovich, which you'll hear on an Explorations in Music this fall or on March 16th at Herb's Theater. Thank you so much for taking some time today, Robert.
My great pleasure.
Music of Dmitri Shostakovich from his Quartet No. 8, which you can hear on March 16th as part of SF Performances and the String Quartet at a Time of War with Robert Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet. My very special guest is Bill Bennett, not the conservative talking head and former Secretary of Education Bill Bennett, nor the preeminent flutist William Bennett, but Bill Bennett, principal oboist extraordinaire of the San Francisco Symphony. Bill is actually one of the senior-most members of the orchestra, maybe not in age, but at least in terms of tenure, celebrating 30-plus years with the orchestra as principal oboe since 1987. He'll be performing the Oboe Concerto of Richard Strauss this week with guest conductor Jan-Pascal Tortelier on a program that also includes Mendelssohn's First Symphony and the Petite Suite of Claude Debussy. Bill, welcome back to KLW in open air.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Richard Strauss may be more familiar to some of our listeners as composer of the tone poems for orchestra like Till Eulenspiegel or Ein Heldenleben, maybe perhaps the 2001 theme, the also Sprach Zarathustra, or perhaps his operas Der Rosenkavalier or other light classics like Salome or Elektra. But this dates from his very end of his life, actually the last 2 years of his life. But his career was informed by some really wonderful oboe writing in his earlier works. I'm wondering if you could maybe share some of those earlier passages that helped create the sound for the oboe concerto.
Well, sure. For oboists, of course, Strauss is a great master at orchestration and wrote some of the most beautiful solos that we have. And that was actually part of the genesis of the work, was just that the man who suggested that he write it, a private in the army named John Delancey, at the end of World War II, visited him in Garmisch and said, "Hey, you've written some really beautiful oboe solos. Why don't you write a concerto?" And Strauss said, "No." And then about a year later, Delancey read about it in the paper that Strauss had written an oboe concerto for some private soldier from Chicago. And actually, Delancey was from Pittsburgh at that point and then became the principal oboe of the Philadelphia Orchestra. But the solos that inspired John Delancey are the same ones that inspired me and countless other oboe players. And he wrote some beautiful melodies that we all know and love, from Don Juan and Till Eulenspiegel, Death and Transfiguration, an Alpine Symphony. And you can hear little bits and snatches of them throughout the oboe concerto, because this was a piece that Strauss used as a way of looking back at the rest of his life, from the very earliest pieces that he wrote, like the Serenade for Wind Instruments, which is suggested in the second movement.
Let's hear just a little bit of that serenade to let people know a little bit of the earlier sound of Richard Strauss. Just an excerpt from Richard Strauss's Serenade for Winds, the Netherlands Wind Ensemble under the direction of Ado de Vart.
Who gave me my first job with the San Francisco Symphony in 1979. I joined as associate principal to Mark Lifshey, who was one of my all-time idols, and played many of those beautiful solos that I got to know through record collecting and practicing. And Don Juan was one of those favorites. You might want to listen to that.
Here's an excerpt from Don Juan of Richard Strauss, Mark Lifshey performing oboe with the Cleveland Orchestra.
I think that one of the things that solo shows is how Strauss was very tuned into what the oboe could do within the palette of a large orchestra. And typically he used the oboe for those very tender moments, the love scenes, the fragile moments like in Death and Transfiguration, the moment on the top of the mountain and an Alpine Symphony, when everything is brought down to this very introspective and soul-searching kind of character.
Which is actually kind of counterintuitive to this grand climax of this grand symphony, Alpine Symphony. Instead of a full orchestra, we have it brought down to a lone oboist, perhaps at the top of the mountain. We do have a recording of you performing that solo.
That's right. We recorded this with Herbert Blumstedt.
Bill Bennett with Herbert Blumstedt and the San Francisco Symphony in this brief excerpt from Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony.
So those of you who know all of this music may also know late Strauss and the vocabulary that he used then, as might be evidenced best by Four Last Songs, which obviously uses a real vocal soloist as opposed to the vocal kind of inflections that an oboe can give. And that brings us to the time of the Oboe Concerto. We've already talked about the genesis of that work. But now we'll talk a little bit about how it's put together.
Well, it doesn't have a program like a tone poem. Since it's in his last couple of years of life, he had kind of moved away from that kind of programmatic feeling. But it begins almost as pastorally as that mountaintop on the Alpine Symphony. I'm wondering if you have a personal narrative that you add to it or that you encourage your students to create.
Well, I like to think of it as pastoral, as you say. I think that one of the things that you'll hear is that it starts with a kind of a rhythmic motor, which is in the form of just four simple notes on the cellos. And they go doodle-doodle, doodle-doodle, and then the oboe is off and running. So here's a recording of the Oboe Concerto played by John Delancey, who was the inspiration for the piece, and you can hear that it starts with a kind of motor rhythm, which runs throughout the piece. And the piece, by the way, is in four connected movements. So it's a little bit like a tone poem, but it's actually much more classical in structure. And that first movement features a lot of sort of trickling runs and 16th notes, which would suggest kind of vocal lines in a way, although it's obviously more virtuosic and instrumental.
Here's John Delancey performing the opening of the Oboe Concerto of Richard Strauss, which will be performed this weekend by Bill Bennett, principal oboist of the San Francisco Symphony.
As the first movement winds down, you hear the motor rhythm, the 16th notes that I was talking about, transition from 4-4 to 3-4 and give you the basis for a kind of lullaby-like second movement.
Thank you.
So, Bill, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your personal path to this concerto.
So the Strauss Oboe Concerto is obviously a touchstone for oboe players, and I've had the good fortune to have performed it twice before, each time separated by 20 years. And the first time was in college, and the second time was with the San Francisco Symphony in 1992. So with that much time separating each performance that I've done of the piece, I've noticed that my perspective has changed. Obviously, when I was a kid playing the piece, it was kind of an athletic contest, and I was very interested in just hitting all the notes and playing them as fast as possible. And over the years, I've sort of broadened my approach to look at it as much more of a vocal exercise, where each note has a very lyrical portent, and I try to express that part of the piece more and more as I get older.
Well, that opening solo for the oboist that we talked about earlier is just epic in itself. It's that long, rather pastoral melody that unwinds for some 57 measures or so with barely a chance to take a breath. And approaching it as a vocalist, I'm sure you've adapted a way to bring it out in a much more lyric way.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do.
What's coming the rest of this season that you're looking forward to within the wind section of the orchestra rather than a soloist?
Well, of course, there are staples of the oboe repertoire that I'll be looking forward to. Brahms First, Mahler 9, but there's also some other pieces that we play much more rarely and that I'm very interested in playing. Honegger Pacific 231, for example, uses the orchestra in quite a unique way to express the workings of a huge locomotive. So futurist music is in there. There are some other pieces that I haven't played before. The big orchestration of the Schoenberg Chamber Symphony should be fun to play.
Well, we look forward to hearing you. We're so lucky to have you as our hometown principal oboist, Bill Bennett. Some 30-plus years with the San Francisco Symphony. Best of luck with these performances of the Richard Strauss Oboe Concerto and beyond. And, of course, continued good health to you.
Thank you very much.
Excerpt from the great John Delancey, the Oboe Concerto of Richard Strauss. All Too Brief here on KALW in open air. You can hear Bill Bennett as the soloist for the Strauss Oboe Concerto with Jan-Pascal Tortelier as guest conductor with the San Francisco Symphony. Also on that program, Mendelssohn's First Symphony, the Debussy Petite Suite. One concert about to take place literally moments from now, 2 p.m. at Davies Symphony Hall, also Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. Information at sfsymphony.org. I'm David Latulip. You've been listening to Open Air. Thanks again to producer Neil Swinkles for preparation and helping the show run. Coming up next, it's an hour of news from the BBC. Stay tuned.